Jim Aiton, professor of English, Southern Utah University.
Let me start you in your introduction. You quote Camus, "One must imagine Sisyphus happy." This is under a picture of Jimmy Jones near the end of his life.
Right.
Why did you choose that
quote? Well, I'm a big fan of Camus, first off, and I think it's a wonderful myth that describes the way we push a rock to the top. We never quite get it there, and I think Jimmy and his art got about as close as anyone could expect an artist to do.
Including some really great work as he was dying.
Right. It's amazing that he kept getting better and better and better, and that the last 2 years of his life, when he was dying of emphysema, he was painting his last show, which was his best work. It's not unheard of among artists to do their best work toward the end, Cezanne and some others, but more often it's not the case. So quite extraordinary feat.
So we'll loop back and get some elements of his life, but the beginning here, what would you sum up? What does Jimmy Jones mean? What would be the five-sentence description of his legacy?
Well, I think art historian Vern Swanson said it better than I did. He called him the premier landscapist of Southern Utah. And I think that is was back in the 90s when he said it, and is still an accurate statement.
So he was raised in Cedar City, was he?
He was born and raised in Cedar City. His great-grandfather was actually the founder of Cedar City, Henry Lunt. So he had came from a prominent family in Cedar City, the Jones family, the Jones and the Lunts.
And he, as you put it, he left high school, didn't graduate.
Correct.
But somehow his parents scraped together enough money to send him to a good art school.
To Art Center, which tuition was about the same in 1951 as the tuition at Harvard. It was about $500.
Wow.
If you can imagine.
So he must have shown some promise.
He did. Early on, his interest in art was obvious to his parents and his teachers, and he used to spend a lot of days just drawing by himself, copying cartoon characters out of the paper, doing art for his classes. And we actually have quite a few of his early crayon drawings. His mother saved those. So you can see a landscape that he actually did when he was probably about 7 or 8 years old, and even see elements that he intuited then that he was using at the end of his life in terms of composing landscape.
You could see that early.
You could see that early. Mm-hmm. One thing, the way he used trees, the way he got a sense of depth in this second grade drawing, quite extraordinary.
Is that unusual to have an artist's drawings for that early?
I think it probably is, but I'm not sure. I'm not an art historian, but I think it is pretty unusual.
Yeah. So it went to art school. And maybe skipping over a bit here, but he fell in love with Mexico.
He did. When he eventually returned to Utah and graduated from the University of Utah in 1961, and his mentor at the time, Alvin Gittens, who's a very famous Utah portrait painter, said, just go off somewhere and paint. And he and his brother Scott had been reading a novel set in Mexico called Under the Volcano by a British novelist named Malcolm Lowry. And they were just consumed by the novel. They just thought it was the best thing they'd ever read. And so they said, we've got to go find some of these places. And somehow they heard about the town of San Blas on the west coast south of Mazatlan. And they ended up there late in the fall of 1961, and Jones said he just fell in love with the place. He had no idea when he went there that it would turn into this 14-year passionate love affair.
What was it about San Blas that he loved so much?
Well, he said everything about it. He loved the people. He loved the environment. San Blas is a port town, but it sets at the base of some mountains. He loved the food, the colors of things, the smells. it just all of it, he said he absolutely loved.
Mm. Now, he's known as a landscape artist, but he, right. You know, there are quite a few portraits of people.
Well, he started out, and this is fairly typical in the 1950s, he started out as a portrait and figure painter. And that's what he did all through school. And then as he started his career as a professional painter in 1961, he largely did portrait and figure work. He did do a few landscapes, some beachscapes down in San Blas. And then a little bit later in the early 70s, he was doing some landscapes of southern Utah, but they're very, very different in his palette than what he then eventually did as a landscape painter.
Mm. You mentioned his brother Scott. Was this right. the one he would follow into adventures?
Exactly.
One relative said that Scott and Jimmy both loved adventure, loved to hit the accelerator, you might say, but Jimmy had brakes and Scott
right.
didn't.
Scott didn't. Scott was, by all accounts, a larger-than-life figure, just absolutely charismatic and full of energy and always leading Jimmy and his friends into various adventures. Mm. And they were best friends from the time Jimmy was born until the time Scott died of AIDS in 1994.
Mm. He tell me a little bit about his other siblings. He had another brother. Who I understand you looked to as kind of a father
figure. Had an older brother, Gary, who's still alive, lives down in Salt Lake City. Gary was about 7-8 years older than Jimmy. they were not real close because of the age difference growing up, but then later when they became adults. When Jimmy was in Utah, he and Gary became very close and were close to the end of Jimmy's life. He was sort of almost a father figure in many ways to Jimmy. He had his brother Scott and then two younger sisters. He was close to all of his siblings. The Jones family was very close. His younger sister Dorothy, who he lived with in Los Angeles and was very close to, and then his youngest sister, Pat, who's still alive and lives down in Pleasant Grove.
Mm. At a certain point, he fell in love with the Grand Canyon and decided to paint as many different viewpoints or
right.
vistas from the Grand Canyon as he could.
Well, I think he fell in love with the Grand Canyon as a young man working there. He worked for the Utah Parks Company. His father was a clerk for the Utah Parks Company. So he first went to the Grand Canyon probably when he was 6, 7, 8 years old. It was always a place he loved. But then once he made the shift into landscape painting after his first successful show at the Phillips Gallery in 1977, he thought, I should try to paint the Grand Canyon. And so he then arranged to be the caretaker that winter of 1977-78. he lived there through the winter in a cabin about a mile and a quarter from the rim. His studio was the sunroom, had no heat, of course. And that winter was a real turning point in his life as a landscape painter. He said, I found what I was meant to do.
Mm. Which was landscape?
Which was landscape painting,
yeah.
Yes.
What was it about landscapes, and in particular those landscapes in
well,
southern Utah?
Well, he always loved southern Utah. He mm-hmm. grew up in a family that loved the landscape in southern Utah. His father, his mother, his uncle Randall, who was very involved in developing the park. So it was just in his blood. His parents would always take them out to the parks. He said his earliest memory was a picnic in Zion, Narrows, when he was a baby. So it was something about that landscape he just grew up with in his blood. He always loved it, but he didn't really think about painting it until 1975 when he was thinking of a bicentennial project. And he thought, I'll paint my home park. I've got to try something different. And no one has really painted Zion all that much, and he did, and that worked out. And then he spent that year at the Grand Canyon and realized that this was what he was meant to do.
Mm. You write, Jones was a big fan of Major Powell, talking about John Wesley Powell, And it is as though the scientist and Grand Canyon explorer had anticipated every problem that Jones would encounter as he attempted to paint the canyon that winter and over the next three decades. You know something about John Wesley Powell.
I do.
I understand. You've written a book on him.
I have. He was a big fan of Powell's because, for one, he admired his writing. And two, Jimmy did a lot of kayaking on the rivers of the Colorado Plateau in the 1960s. And so that was before river guides. He would take Major Powell's book and Dellenbaugh's book down with him as guides and read passages and sort of follow in Major Powell's footsteps. And he admired, of course, what not just what Powell wrote, but his accomplishments as a scientist and a land planner and his environmental ethic.
That is an incredible way to see the land, isn't it, through the on the river?
Well, in my opinion, I'm a river runner. Right. I'm biased. I think it's the best way to see the canyons.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the paintings, and when you're not an art historian, but you're covering an artist here.
Right.
So I don't know if you talked to artists or
I did. I was. I've always had an interest in art, but I was fortunate to have quite a few artist friends, all of whom knew Jimmy and his work well. And they would sit down with me and we would go through the paintings and they would sort of talk about them and educate me as to what he was doing as an artist, how he was composing things, how he was using different colors to get different effects. So I owe a great deal to those artist friends. Mm. For
I want to mention one that really stood out to me. This is, I think, because of the light. It's the pulpit of Sinuava.
Sinuava.
I've never been there. I've only been to the main canyon in Zion.
Well, that is in the main canyon.
Oh, is it in the main canyon?
It's close to the Narrows. It's down around an area called Big Bend, and it's kind of easy to miss when you're driving because it's sort of on your left behind you as you make the turn.
And I think I did miss it when I went, unfortunately. This is just a beautiful painting, and as I said, because of the light.
Mm-hmm. He first painted that his first year in Zion, that area of Big Bend, and he came back to it again and again and again. He probably did 40, 50 paintings in that area, and he loved the area, he said, but it was a real challenge. You know, what do you leave out? What do you put in? His mentor, George Dibble, said painting it is sort of like backing a tiger into a corner. But he did quite a few just of that pulpit, and I think they are, you're right, they're some of the most extraordinary paintings, just the way he gets the light effects on the temple.
Mm. So that was one of his favorite areas.
It was.
Yeah.
He said Big Bend area just took his breath away. He mm-hmm. loved painting it.
I wonder if you could expand on that. That is quite the metaphor, backing a or similarly,
backing a tiger into a corner
is what painting is, apparently.
Or at least in a place like that where it's so confined and yet so on such a large scale. The walls are just really huge there, and so you have to try to figure out, you know, what am I going to leave in? What am I going to take out? How do I simplify it? How do I get, you know, lighting effects and so forth?
At a certain point, a very important project to him, he built or he helped build a house.
Well, he built two houses.
Oh, two houses, okay.
The first was the family cabin up on Cedar Mountain. The Jones family had always loved Cedar Mountain and had dreamed about having a cabin there. And finally, they broke ground in 1968, and they bought a kit and then put it together and built it. And all the family participated in it, Jimmy more than anyone else. Jimmy had always had an interest in architecture. His uncle, Randall Jones, was a well-known architect in Salt Lake. And it even at one point he thought he might give up painting and become an architect. So he really poured himself into that cabin, and it drew him back into the Southern Utah landscape, got him thinking about painting it, and then it got him thinking about building his own house, which he finally did, broke ground on in 1983. just outside of Zion National Park on a mesa in Rockville.
Mm. And you quote Arlene Braithwaite, landscape artist, who said, Jim Jones found Eden, and it was right outside his window.
Right. So when he found this piece of land and bought it and started to build his house, he spent as much time on that house as he did his paintings. And it really is a work of art in itself. And it took a couple of decades for him to finish it because he would pay his workers to work on the house up to a certain point, then he'd be out of money. Then he would paint like crazy and make some more money and then do more work on the house. So it was a long, gradual process to get it finished. Mm-hmm. And even when he died in 2009, it wasn't absolutely completely finished.
Mm-hmm. Did you know him personally?
I did. He was a good friend.
Yeah. What stands out to you from your personal knowledge of Jimmy?
Well, Jimmy was... beloved. He was maybe one of the best human beings I've ever known in my life. Besides being a great landscape painter, he was kind, he was generous, he was a great listener, he was funny, he was well-read, you could talk to him about anything. He was just a joy to be around. People just absolutely loved Jimmy. Mm. And he had friends from all over the country. Of course, lots of friends in southern Utah of all sorts of people. People just loved him. Hmm. Just a wonderful person.
One of the things that was important to him, especially near the end of his life, I understand, is leaving as a legacy, beginning as of an art museum.
Correct.
At Southern Utah University.
Correct. This sort of started with a conversation with one of his former art professors, Angelo Caravaglia, who one of his main professors at the U, and he was down visiting Jimmy, and he said, you need to do something with your paintings, even if it's just a little house in Cedar City. And that got him thinking, well, Cedar City needs a really good art museum. And so he approached then-president Michael T. Benson and invited him down to his house and said, if I give you everything I have, my house, my works, the copyright to all of my paintings, would you commit to building an art museum in Cedar City? And Mike Benson said immediately, yes. And so when Jimmy died, his house sold for $650,000, and that became the seed money with which the university was then able to go to other donors to raise the $10 to $12 million that it took to build this extraordinary museum, which we opened this summer. There's no building like it in Utah. And I would urge everyone, if they haven't been to see it, to come see it.
Mm. What would Jimmy Jones say about his legacy as an artist, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. Jimmy always saw himself as a working painter. He never called himself an artist. He said, I'm a painter. Because he made a living as a painter. He didn't do anything else. He wasn't a professor or anything else. He saw himself primarily as a landscape painter, and he thought that his best work was his landscape. He once told me that he said, just when I became where I thought I knew something about figure painting, he said, my interest was usurped by landscape painting. Mm-hmm. But he was so humble and so self-deprecating. He didn't really worry about his legacy. He just wanted to make a living, paint good work, and let someone else kind of figure it all out.
I imagine you talked to those someones else. You know, the legacy.
Right.
What do artists say? What do art historians say about his
well,
legacy?
Well, as going back to Vern Swanson's comment, he is the premier landscapist of southern Utah, and he was one of the first, really. When he grew up in Cedar City, there were no models for him. So for him to become an artist was a really bold step. And he painted really the canyon country like no one else. One of the things that distinguishes a Jimmy Jones painting is that sense of depth, when you look in his work, you can see into the painting. He called being able to see through a painting. He said one of the things that he really liked was one time he was up in Springville at an elementary school, and a little girl came up to him and said, "One of the things I like about your paintings is I can see so far." And I think that's as much as anything what distinguishes his work from all the other hundreds of people that paint Southern Utah.
I noticed he must have referred to himself as Jimmy, not Jim. Or,
well, that's a good question. He was born Jimmy. His birth certificate says Jimmy,
oh, okay.
i.e., not James. And as a young man, he was Jimmy. But about the time he started painting professionally, late 50s, early 60s, he decided to show as Jim Jones. So many people know him as Jim. Many people know him as Jimmy. I was introduced to him as Jimmy when I met him in 1980. And so probably as many people that I know who knew Jimmy called him Jimmy, and about equal number call him Jim. So.
Okay. I notice his headstone says Jimmy.
Right.
And then he's apparently signed the headstone?
Well,
did I see that correctly, or signed the picture?
His brother.
Or somebody signed the.
He told his brother, "All I want is my name and my dates."
Okay.
But his brother said, "I embellished it." So he put the brushes, and then he had Jimmy's signature, which he used on his paintings, J. Jones. He had that copied, however someone does that.
Okay. Oh, that's what that was. Yeah. I thought maybe Jimmy Jones himself, before he died, had prepped that.
No,
his brother took that. That's a nice touch, isn't it?
His signature way of signing his paintings.
Yeah, that is a nice touch.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to say about Jimmy Jones and his work?
Let's see. One of the things that a lot of people don't know about Jimmy is that he was incredibly well-read, and that he said, "I paint in order to read." He was voraciously reading every day, all day. Probably the most well-read person I've ever met. And he loved to talk about books. He didn't like to talk about art. In fact, he said what he used to joke that what he wanted on his tombstone to say was he didn't give a hoot about art. In other words, he didn't care about all that. You know, I'm the precious artist. He liked to talk about things that he had read.
So he was an artist, but he didn't like to talk about
art. Right. He did talk about art. And with some of his friends, but it was not an all-consuming thing. It's what he did. It was his passion. It was his job. But he just didn't like to talk art talk.
Right. Well, I guess he felt he expressed himself
exactly.
through his art, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. He said, "When you see a Rembrandt, you're speechless." And I suppose that's what he hoped that people would do when they saw his work.
Were there influences on him?
Oh, absolutely. He had his favorite painters, many big names. Maynard Dixon was an influence. Vermeer was one of his favorite painters. He loved George O'Keeffe, the American realist Thomas Eakins, Winslow Homer, Maxfield Parrish. He loved all of those painters' works. And, of course, there were his teachers that he had at Art Center and Santa Monica College and then at University of Utah, particularly Alvin Gittins. All of these were a big influence on Jimmy's work.
Do we see younger artists coming up influenced by Jimmy Jones?
Oh, yes. Many of the people who helped me with this who are prominent Southern Utah landscape is Brad Holt. His mother was a good friend of Jimmy's, and Jimmy actually got Brad started as a painter, gave him some brushes and some paints and kind of showed him how to stretch a canvas. And Brad is now a very prominent Southern Utah artist. Arlene Braithwaite, Spike Ress, many of the Kate Starling, many of the prominent painters in southern Utah, all revere Jimmy and his work.
Just parenthetically, just I remember this part. He apparently didn't use a palette; he used a Melmac plate,
right?
Because he didn't use all that many. He didn't use a great amount of paint.
No, he didn't. For his palette. So he would put a little bit of paint on there and paint for usually 3 or 4 hours a day, and that seemed to be enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, very interesting. A wonderful book. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.